Just to order this Wednesday, March 23rd. We're going to take a look at our agenda this morning. We're going to swap the agenda around a little bit. We have an informational meeting where we're going to hear a presentation about kids. It's called Fighting Crime, Invest in Kids, Oregon. So we're probably going to take that a little bit later. We're going to reverse the agenda to bring up some work sessions to move some bills out very briefly. And then we're waiting for House Speaker Karen Mintz to come down and testify on House Bill 2010, and then we will take the informational meeting after that. So those are a couple of words. Colleagues, we're going to work some bills out this morning. You have in your stack some hand-engrossed copies of bills that take into account the amendments that we have to work. These were pretty straightforward bills that we heard before. No real contentious aspects, particularly on House Bill 2080. So there's that. And also, we heard a presentation by Dr. Jim Lace last Friday. He was one of the physicians that came up and testified on the AIDS bill. And he left some informational items about a project that he works on, which is he volunteers to go to an orphanage in Tanzania to provide health care at that orphanage. And it's really a great program. I've contributed before, and he does terrific work. So I was just going to pass this out for your information. So we'll just kind of send that down. Speaker's here now. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2010, and we'll ask staff to introduce that bill to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. House Bill 2010 is before the committee at the request of Bernie Giusto, the Multnomah County Sheriff. What this is requesting is that it directs the Attorney General to create a Children Protection Unit within the Department of Justice. It's requiring that the Children Protection Unit shall provide oversight in the manner in which the Department of Human Services currently performs its duty relating to protection of children. As a footnote, Mr. Chair, when we had Mr. Sheriff Giusto before us earlier on the child foster children issue, the chair had requested just some general information from his perspective. I have some testimony that addresses that in a general fashion.
Terrific. Thanks very much. I'd like to invite House Speaker Karen Mintz forward and Sheriff Bernie Giusto with Multnomah County Sheriff's Office to introduce this measure to us. And, Colin, just came out of some of our efforts earlier this session in this committee to work through the issues of child abuse that came up in the month of December. And this is the first product of a pretty comprehensive effort that we're going to undertake to try to get to the heart of this child abuse. So with that, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Karen Mintz, State Representative from House District 49, and I want to thank you for bringing this bill up for hearing. It's an important issue, and it's an issue that we have tried to grapple with for years, and there's been a lot of tragedy that brings us to the point we're at today. Protection of children is a vital responsibility. The Department of Human Services has a difficult job when it comes to protecting children. I know that the men and women who work in Child Protective Services care very deeply about the welfare of the children entrusted to their care. However, there are enough inconsistencies in how cases are handled between branch offices that I think greater oversight would be helpful. Last session, we allocated 200 new positions to DHS. However, the system did not allocate enough of those positions for caseload management. Thus, we have further difficulty in the caseload issue. That's why I strongly support House Bill 2010 and the creation of a child protection unit within the Department of Justice to oversee child protection within DHS. Over the years, several law enforcement officers have expressed their concerns to me regarding this matter and also their frustrations. Most recently, Sheriff Giusto brought this to my attention after a tragic incident that happened out in Gresham. A little girl was killed. and his, he could probably talk about just the frustration of getting some cooperation to do a proper investigation of the incidents. Our goal here is to not to condemn DHS, but to offer a constructive suggestion of how to improve oversight to ensure better protection of the children who most need protection. It's critical to have an independent office to oversee this vital program of state government. This unit would be able to go into field offices unannounced to audit records and do case review. This unit will be a day-to-day maintenance of the trust we as citizens of the state place with our government in protecting the children of the state and society. The existing systems are not working. That's why we need a unit like this. Established to protect the children that come into the state's care and prevent any tragedies like the Lopez case in Gresham. We believe the Attorney General, as an elected official, can provide objective, independent, outside of the department oversight to investigate problems and help prevent future problems. With this unit in the AG's office, we won't need to be concerned with about pitting one function against the other. For example, if it was in the state police, they would have the same difficulty. But this unit would be an official unit of the state who is answerable to the voters. We believe that an outside framework, an outside unit to come in and be able to audit, to oversee, to have a piece of accountability would be the most effective way to try to turn this ship. This, again, is a framework for success. It's not meant to catch anyone, but it's meant to help and is meant to help and designed to help agencies help themselves. I encourage your support for the bill, and we'll be happy to work with you in framing any of the language that is necessary.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Bernie Justo. I'm Multnomah County Sheriff. And I think the speaker's covered the points related to the bill itself. And let me just talk about the material in front of you today in my letter. Part of my rationale for asking you to consider making this change in the way Oregon protects its children is my 30 years experience in law enforcement. And I have to tell you that what's not said about this bill is it will bring increased accountability to law enforcement as well. While the bill only addresses the Children Welfare Division, Children Welfare Division, we and law enforcement are inextricably linked to that division. So in cases where our performance, whether it be Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, Malheur County Sheriff's Office, the Portland Police Bureau, or any other agency, aren't living up to our end of it, this process will help also identify those weaknesses and help protect children in individual cases. I think I told you before that nobody's trying to protect every child in Oregon from every bad experience. This bill is meant to close some fairly gaping holes and glaring deficiencies in procedures in protecting children. The cases, although fairly are tragic and fairly they speak for themselves, let me say it that way, is more concerning that when the investigations are completed in these cases by Child Welfare Division, there's really nothing in the material that tells you how it's going to get fixed. What the problem was in the latest case, in the latest cases, you can see that that's exactly the case again, is that the investigation really comes with no specifics as to why it happened, how it's going to be fixed. And in the years past, in my case in Gresham, we were assured, I won't speak for the speaker, but we were assured that those measures were in place not to let what happened in Gresham happen again, or happen not very often. And then followed Miranda Gaddis and Ashley Pond and the Jordan case recently, and many of the same kind of procedural errors are in place. What is in my material today, really 6 points, not to be all-inclusive, but to demonstrate to you what it is about the system that needs to be fixed. Consistency in things like case management, offices from office to office do things differently. inability to get a hold of caseworkers and supervisors after hours in police investigations, inability to access the system after 10 o'clock at night to get information about case history, those kind of things. The 2010 address is not just finding somebody to discipline. That's not what it's meant to address. It's meant to address the system in its entirety, to identify that weakness in case management. Because without strict case management, no matter how many child caseworkers you put on the ground, these situations will continue to occur. Somebody has to prioritize work in a system that's always going to be overburdened. You cannot take what comes to the top of the pile every day and think that's what needs to be done. Supervisors need training. I had the union in my office. I had SEIU in my office and talked to three of their senior business people. As opposed to not supporting this bill, what they told me was they just didn't want caseworkers blamed for what they believed was inadequate supervision, inadequate case management system, to the point at which in the last contract, they explained, they bargained that you have to manage this clause into the contract. You have to supervise this clause in the contract. I've done a lot of public contracts in my life and a lot of different agencies. I don't even know what that means. I've never had a union ask me to please supervise them. It's usually just the opposite. Is they're usually trying to get less management right, not more management right. Now, I'm not trying to be flip about this issue, but it demonstrates the fact that the system needs fixing, and it needs fixing by an independent source that has a different view of the world to some degree. I'm not confident that inside the agency, at least at the mission, I think I told you this earlier, that it will work. I'm afraid that the process with good people trying to do good things in very difficult circumstances will be co-opted to the point at which it will become ineffective. Some of the discussion we had last time about CERT teams established around the state, those are great things for afterwards, great things for determining whether or not foster care is going in the right direction in general. It does not do anything for individual concerns, individual cases. It does not say anything about case management. Specific circumstances that have happened in my office, not in this letter, is, again, these caseworkers have a heavy burden, and I want to tell you, I'm not critical of the individual caseworkers, but in a situation where we show up at a school and waiting for a caseworker to take a child out of school, remove that child from the family, and the caseworker doesn't show up because the night before they've been pulled off a case, and the case sat on the caseworker's desk because there's no case management system, nobody shows up at school, we don't remove the child, and off we go. And we don't know that night what that means for that child. I have no idea what it means when we don't remove that child that night or that day from school. Those are the kind of things that 2010 is meant to address. The system is a difficult system, but again, just like law enforcement, that doesn't take us off the hook for internal affairs. I say things are difficult in law enforcement. They are. Believe me, it's a difficult profession. The public's unforgiving about the fact that we don't have a procedural checkpoint through our system. Not just about whether we use too much force, but whether we're polite, whether we drive too fast, whether we follow our procedures, whether we turn in reports on time. That's why we have internal affairs. It's not whether or not we shoot too many people or beat too many people. That's the least of what internal affairs does. That is what this agency needs help with. Again, no condemnation of the individual of the agency. I blame really the leadership in the state, including myself. It's been governor after governor after governor, legislator after legislature after legislature after legislature, sheriff after sheriff after sheriff. It's time we just try something different. The model for this, you might want to know, is New Jersey has an inspector, child protective inspector. I believe the Attorney General's office has the ability to sue the state for changes, has the ability to sue the governor's office for changes in protecting children. The unit functions much like this unit would function. Independent access by the public, independent review and accountability. And again, I got an email yesterday from somebody from CASA, which is the court-appointed advocate, encouraging me that we didn't need this because that group did advocacy. And as I wrote back, thanking that person for their email, I reminded them that this is not about advocacy. This is about accountability. Those are two clearly different things. Advocating for children is different than holding people accountable for their safety. My closing of the letter just asks this question, is that we are their only advocates. Oregon leaders are our only advocates, because once they're dead, or once they're injured, nobody else advocates. If they did, we wouldn't be responsible for their individual safety. So if we are going to change the system, we're going to have to do it in front of the incident, not wait for the incident to happen and shrug our shoulders about it can't be the price of doing business, I don't believe. So anyway, with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Madam Speaker.
Good morning.
Mr. Sheriff.
Thank you.
Happy you're here today. This is an intriguing idea, and I wonder whether you considered the potential of expanding its scope into other places where the state has potential. I mean, I think of OYA. I think of juveniles in the state hospital where we've heard problems. I think of perhaps juvenile detention authorities in the counties. I mean, it would seem to me we might expand this kind of notion. And I know you don't want to give them too big a job so they can't do any of it, but it would seem to me the notion of having an independent look at anywhere where we take responsibility for children would be a very useful tool. I wonder.
There was concern over the gentleman OYA. He'd come from DHS, and nobody caught his behavior before we lost another young person. I would not object if that could be folded into something like this. Again, we don't want to get the scope so large that it's unmanageable. I think in those kinds of instances where we have juveniles that are being supervised, I think having somebody come in and do a snapshot, or at least have an opportunity to come in and review procedures and some of the decisions that have been made. The other component, too, is sometimes when a complaint is filed, it's not passed along to have other people review it. That's another problem. So I would not object to that as long as we don't get the scope of this so broad that it's unmanageable.
And that it swamps it. Yeah.
One of the things that I agree with the speaker on this issue, one of the things we were questioned about that very issue when the Oregonian did an editorial Monday on this topic. But one of the things that comes to mind about placing the Attorney General's office, I have to tell you that a call from the Attorney General's office to almost any agency, regardless of OIA or the Sheriff's Office or CWD, tends to get things moving. And so with some limited resources in the Attorney General's office, they would be able to leverage a lot of other action on the ground once somebody understands that there's an oversight issue there that needs to be recognized. So I think that's possible. I think it's possible to expand it.
Monsieur, can I follow up? I mean, as a suggestion, maybe we could put a piece in that would suggest that the Attorney General look at these other agencies and perhaps come back to the legislature for scope or something. To raise the issue, because I do worry along with you that anytime we have a child in the state's custody, there are children, and therefore we have a very special responsibility for dealing with them.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Madam Speaker, for bringing this issue up. I can tell you I've been very deeply concerned about issues that I've seen in my own county and heard reports, and now in touch with other local offices that I think need oversight, need review desperately. Obviously, we do have a number of problems in overload for caseworkers. We do have issues that may be difficult to deal with, but it just seems to me that in reading your information here, Sheriff Justo, that it's right on target. We've got problems where people are not responding in the way that I think we need to be responding, and I hope that we can get some over review that really will be able to target problems before they happen. Thankfully, we have not had a death in our county that I know of, but I think we're ripe for that kind of situation with the methamphetamine abuses that we're seeing all through the state, and especially in counties like mine that are relatively poor. I have a question for you, and I appreciated your comment about the cert, that that's really an after review. That's too late. I understand there are a number of counties that have multidisciplinary teams. I'm not aware that ours does, but I will check in that. Is that an approach that would be parallel to what you're asking, or is that, again, kind of an after review?
Child abuse teams, multidisciplinary teams, we call them CAT in Multnomah County, where we bring a number of resources together, law enforcement, social services, the district attorney, and that model works very well for the investigation of criminal activity. So abuse is never meant to be a proactive group to take citizen complaints, take a look at case management, and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. I don't want to imply that there is not any effective relationships in these between CWD offices and individual operations in counties or cities. That's not what I'm implying at all. It is not parallel. It's adjunct to, probably it's a supplement to this, but it addresses suspected criminal activity, having nothing to do with the fact that some glaring error in a case is never going to catch a glaring error in a case.
If I could,
administrative error, excuse me.
Follow up on that. One of the difficulties is the confidentiality component of this agency, which is appropriate.
Exactly.
But it's extremely difficult, you know, unless you have something in place like this, for somebody to go in and take an honest view of what the true circumstances are within that agency. When you inquire, you are told, and there are federal guidelines for confidentiality. And I think that's why it's been so difficult to get our arms around this agency and to get a proper perspective of what's working and what's not working.
Right.
When we had our incident in Wasatch Child in Gresham 4 years ago, I sat down with the director of Children's Services, and we talked about this, as Sheriff Giusto alluded to. And I said to her, what can we do to fix this? Well, it's going to be fixed. Don't worry. We're going to have some things in place. And obviously what they put in place was not effective, because here we are today and we've lost more kids. So I think the inability for people to actually go in and understand what's truly happening from an outside perspective is one of the reasons we find ourselves here today.
I couldn't agree more. As a legislator, when I've gone in with releases, I almost feel like there's a stone wall that drops, that I cannot get to the heart of the matter, to the common sense solution of the matter. And we need some force that can penetrate everything and go in and really evaluate what's been done. Has it been done, is it just a policy issue, or is it a family that's being broken up? It just breaks my heart. And some of the decisions have been made, and there seems to be no review. There's no way to get at what's really right for that family.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for bringing this to us. It's certainly a very important issue. I have several questions, if I may, Mr. Chair.
By all means.
Thank you. Bernie, you mentioned in New Jersey they have an inspector. Is that also through the AG's office?
I believe that's correct. I'd have to make sure that's correct, but I believe that's correct, yes.
Great. I have on my desk, which is not totally clean, but a letter that I'd gotten from Ramona dated January 31st when I asked for the staffing of the SCF. And it's still unclear to me, and I need to make sure I've got a meeting with her to make sure. But it seems to me that staffing for SCF is also a huge issue, and I'm sure that will be coming out if this passes and we have somebody who's going to be looking at these incidents. That and the training of the staff, I mean, that's really clear, too, that is, we need to have better trained staff who are really trained to work with these children, and especially in crisis situation. So I'm assuming that is something that perhaps if this passes that we'll be looking more clearly at that. But also, I hate to bring up the word, but is there a fiscal with this?
That'll be something the committee, once language is developed, then they write fiscal. After you get policy in place, we have a fiscal input.
Okay.
But, in saying that, what is the price of having our kids die? So I think it's we hope to be responsible fiscally with this, but, you know, what is the price of a child's life?
Oh.
We'll have that, of course, as part of the course of this committee.
Okay. The reason I asked this, I didn't know if you meant that this would be still a part of the funding and staffing of the AG's office, that this was going to be a new unit, et cetera. Is that correct?
This will all be done in concert with the AG's office and in cooperation with them to make this work. As to the staffing issue, again, I had some members from the Citizens Review Board come in and visited me yesterday who indicated that there were 200 positions allocated last session, but those positions were not put on the front line where they needed them. They had them up in the management positions. So instead of allocating positions to the front line to help manage the caseload, it was their opinion that the positions were set up the food chain rather than at the front lines where the services are needed. And I think that's something across state government. Rather than cutting the services on the front line, let's go up the chain and make adjustments there where they need to be, if that's the case.
Thank you, Representative. The one piece that was very clear when I met with SEIU, and I wanted to tell you, they're very sincerely concerned about the safety of kids in this state, and their commitment was clear to me after 30 years, hard to pull over my eyes, whether it's just all about their union or it's all about the kids. I think they're all about the kids, but the thing that they highlighted the most to me was the lack of training for their supervisors, supervisor priority and workday activities, which I highlighted in my note, and to be specific was things like attending too many community meetings and not doing enough case supervision work. Those are the kind of adjustments that have got to be made before we're going to make changes. No matter how many caseworkers you have, if in fact supervisors aren't overseeing case management,
right,
and trained to oversee it, so I want to be
right.
Fair to the supervisors as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay, thank you, Representative. We have still a number of questions from the panel. I understand you have to meet with the Senate President, Madam Speaker, at 9 o'clock, and so we may have to excuse you. But before you go, Madam Speaker, you and I had been talking about the possibility of doing specific work in this committee on child abuse, and this, I think, is our vehicle to get that action started, and we're going to take a closer, more in-depth look, go into field offices. We're going to take a group of legislators to sort of hammer this out. So thanks very much for bringing this forward to allow us to do that. Appreciate your commitment to these
thank
kids.
Thank you for taking this up, Chairman.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Sheriff, could you stick around?
I can.
More questions?
I can.
Would that be all right?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Butler, and then Boone, and then Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do appreciate the sensitivity of the Speaker and her commitment to the youth and the children of the state. With that, Sheriff Huster, I come from a very rural county, one of those other M-beginning counties that has a funny name like Multnomah does. And we also have folks that are good providers, good public service personnel, folks that are wearing many hats most all of the time, and by and large do so very well, I might say. But we do have, because of our distance from Salem and our overall distrust of these top-down driven children's services programs, where, as Representative May had indicated, some questions about staffing levels, about training levels, and again, this is a great job for the resource they have. And I'm very concerned about the appearance of the top-down driven, particularly when we hire 200 people to do this, and they all stay in Salem. And one of my most favorite sayings is, are they really the worker bees, or are they the folks that get the water to the end of the row? And if they really aren't, then, you know, I have a serious reservation, sometimes a suspicion of those folks. My question of you, Sheriff Huster, it would be the definition of scope of this kind of a program. Mm-hmm. What's to keep it from expanding? In other words, my constituents are most likely wanting to, and they have to have a place to vent their frustrations when they don't see the water get to the end of the row in our rural district. So our propensity, of course, is to use up all of our elephant-sized bullets on rabbit-sized problems, and come immediately to this kind of a program, and my concern is that the scope be maintained to address a specific topic in a specific area and not get outside of being Again, coming back to the issue, we've got CASA and the special court-appointed special advocates, and where we maintain accountability and not advocacy in these programs.
Those are questions that are probably a little bit outside of my ability to promise you control over, but in terms of keeping this under control. What I can tell you is, again, the more resources that you pour into the agency, whether it be DHS generally or Child Welfare Division, much like running a sheriff's office. I run a sheriff's office of 850 employees. My sheriff's office knows that the next body we'll hire going into the jails or onto the street or a sergeant will not be a lieutenant, will not be a captain, will not be another deputy chief. Just my philosophy. I've worked in the kind of counties you've talked about with state police. I worked in Gideon County, Wheeler County, John Day, Umatilla County, Morrow County. So I understand your constituency to some degree. I think, again, what will limit it, first of all, as it always does in an office like the Attorney General's, is the fact that the monetary, the finances will, the AG, like the sheriff, the finances, she will be reticent to come back to the legislature and say, I need 15 more positions for this job. I think the cost benefit, is that if the unit functions as an inspection, it ought to function. I don't like the word efficiencies, but the inside look the agency will have to take it itself will get some of those 200 positions pushed down to the street, because the AG, I'm not speaking for Attorney General Myers at this point, but the Attorney General's office is not going to play the role of the fool in terms of what they see and don't report. I think the scope of what this bill is about is more than just about catching people who don't do the right things day in and day out and are doing their work. The scope of the bill should be intended, and I think the intention that Representative Tomei talked about is exactly that. It's about things like our positions being used correctly. Is case management really hitting the ground? Is the water getting to the end of the line? The water gets to the end of the line when the supervisor makes it get to the end of the line. Only the supervisor can do it. The director can't do it. I don't care how good they are. The sheriff can't do it every day. My sergeants know that I count on them every day. I talk to them day in and day out about the fact that if the policy doesn't hit the street, it'll be because you don't make it hit the street. So I give them the authority to do it and the expectation they'll get it done. That's what this process should get to as well. Because protecting kids is more than just whether or not we do the right home visits and that kind of thing. Are the resources being directed in priority order, and are they actually meeting the expectation of what the agency is supposed to do? Supervisors have to have that mentality. When they do, we'll change the trend in the state.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Now, Representative Boone.
Well, I wanted to say thank you also and pass that along to the speaker, too.
Thank you
for bringing this to us. I think it should be welcomed by all. It'd make everyone's job a little bit easier if it would, because it's like an extra set of eyes, a different set of eyes and oversight. And I agree, I had it on my list, too, Representative Greenlick, to add OIA to it. I think that's important, not just because of what happened to Mr. Munoz, but so many of our kids, when they make it to that point, they have been in the earlier end of it too, under Department of Human Services. So I just think it's a very exciting new direction to take, and I'm all for it. And any way I can help you, let me know.
Thank you. One of the things that I'd highlight for you so that I want to go back to the law enforcement accountability piece. And as I said, when the Attorney General speaks, although sometimes the office is underestimated in terms of its impact, the discussion about grand juries with law enforcement now that's going on in terms of opening grand juries to the public, at least having them recorded and have the transcripts available to the public, is exactly the function that we're talking about here. The Attorney General has gathered law enforcement, including myself, together and said, what the process we have now is undermining public trust. We've got to figure out some compromise that protects the rights of the officers and at the same time gives the public confidence that we're doing business in full view of them. And the Attorney General is probably going to win that when he brings it to the legislature, I don't think, without any question. That is something that he'll win some piece of that. It's no different than this element here. The fact is that that office should have, and I hope the legislature would support the ability to have have unfettered access to the process and to the information in the process, and I believe that will deliver the results that you're looking for, and it's just simply the better protection of kids. It's not about the agency or the workers, except supporting them to make them more successful. That's all.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Representative Cannon.
Thank you. I understand the importance of your internal affairs and how that kind of holds you accountable and keeps you honest, but as in some of your written testimony here, calling a hotline after 10 o'clock, if people called the Sheriff's Department after 10 o'clock and got a recording, would that require internal policy within your sheriff's department?
Well,
is there a reason why we're not changing things now so that you get a live person on a pager at midnight?
No, it really wouldn't, Representative. I understand your point. The answer is no, it wouldn't necessarily. But in places where accountability isn't or responsiveness isn't necessarily the most important thing in the management's philosophy, those changes will never occur without
change the management.
Well, you change the management, yes, sir, you can. Or the governor can simply say, do it, or that kind of thing, and we don't expect the governor to get that level of detail. I guess the answer to your question is no, it should not take that. You're right. No, it should not take that. But you can reach anyone in the sheriff's office any time of day, including myself. You know, so
really somebody could change in this department today a procedure that would allow to have somebody on call or a pager so that your officers could reach them without going through this whole internal affairs procedure. I just want to make that.
Well, those kind of changes, yes. The administrative practices of case management, prioritization, those kind of things, not the aptitude for it without some outside review.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. I don't know that we can take up a whole lot more time at this point with these questions, but Sheriff, do you still, we appreciate you being here on this bill, and we're probably going to invite you back if that's okay.
Yes, sir.
We're going to do quite a bit of work on this, so thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Next, I'd like to ask Pete Shepherd to come forward with the Department of Justice.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. Attorney General Harry Myers asked me to come over and visit with you about House Bill 2010, in part because the Attorney General believes that nobody should turn a deaf ear to anyone with an idea for how better to protect the most vulnerable kids who are in the state's charge. I take House Bill 2010 as the beginning of a conversation rather than the ending point. I take that both from the fact that I think it raises some questions that need to be examined closely and also from the comments of the Speaker and the Chair, and I'm pleased to offer the Department's assistance in participating in that conversation. Let me offer just three suggestions, and then in light of the fact that this is the start of a conversation rather than the end. And these are along the lines of considerations that you might want to think about as you work through the best way to approach these issues and to accomplish what it is you want to accomplish. And the first of those is to be very clear as you go into this process, or perhaps be very clear to try and develop an answer to the question of what you perceive to be the key problem of problems. And the reason that I suggest that, and I'm heartened to hear that you're going to be visiting DHS offices and working with DHS to try and identify the issues, is that the answer to that question, the identification of the specific problem or problems, may help inform you about the best way to craft the solution. And in particular, one example of that would be how you might, what agency or what entity you might either create or, if you pick an existing agency, to whom you might assign the primary function. Let's take the bill as it stands. It assigns the function to the Department of Justice. That might be the right place institutionally to place such an assignment if your identification of the problem is that there's a law compliance issue, that in some way the state has not been complying with an obligation of law or meeting legal standards that it that it ought to be meeting. But if your identification of the problem or issue is that there have been administrative judgments or policy judgments within a range permitted by law, then the Department of Justice doesn't have specialized expertise that would be particularly helpful, as currently constituted at least, to assist in accomplishing the goal of it, trying to ensure that better judgments are the outcome of this process. That in part stems from the current statutory assignment that the Department of Justice has. Under Chapter 180, our department is charged with providing legal counsel and advice, and while it's flattering to know that we also can help influence policy in other areas, as the sheriff has suggested, and indeed we try to use the office to try and influence policy in other areas as well, our statutory charge is to provide counsel and advice to state agencies and on behalf of the state of Oregon to try and ensure law compliance and consistent application of the rule of law. The statutes currently establish in Chapter 180 a pretty rigorous distinction between our function as the legal policy. The Attorney General announces the legal policy for the state, but agencies have, under current law, the responsibility of determining policy within their statutory framework. And so, to the extent that what you would like to do is try and identify a better way to hold agencies accountable for policy judgments or administrative judgments, that currently is a function that the Department of Justice wouldn't bring any specialized expertise to bear on in respect to, for example, the protection of kids. We can help with the legal piece of that, but the policy piece of that is not something that we currently have unique expertise in. The second suggestion I'd give you as you go into this process has been alluded to briefly by one of the questions from Representative Tomei, and that is that there are other models for this kind of a system. A question was asked about how it was accomplished, I think, in New Jersey. There also are inspector general models that the committee might wish to look at. And those kinds of offices, the offices of inspector general, can be created even within a given agency. But to the extent your goal is to try and create an independent or objective a review process on the model, for instance, of an internal affairs department of a police department, you could consider creating inspector general offices that had statutory charge that insulated them and provided them with some degree of independence and an outside perspective, though located even within a given agency. So there are other models to look at for the way you might structure this. And then the final suggestion I'd have for you is that, and again it's been alluded to in the questions that have been asked, I would think that the committee would want to take a really close look at the question of where the resources that would be required to undertake the kind of effort that's been described here, where those would most effectively be expended. And that's going to require some very careful judgments about whether expending those resources, and I can't give you any sense right now of what kind of additional resources, for instance, the Department of Justice would require to successfully discharge the responsibilities even of the printed bill, though I know that they would be significant. And I think a question that the committee would want to look really closely at with the assistance of the Department of Human Services and others involved is where those resources could best be spent. Is there, for example, a targeted investment of those same resources at the front end, for example, in how better to handle dependency cases so that the judgments are made in a better way at the front end of that process? Is that going to be a better expenditure of the same dollar that you otherwise would expend on an inspector general's office or on the Department of Justice? I don't know the answer to that question, but it seems to me it would be a very important one for the committee to ask as it proceeds in its deliberations. So, in conclusion, I'd simply say we would be very pleased to help the committee in a process that we hope would include at least those three considerations I described, and I'm sure others. And I would encourage the committee to directly engage the Department of Human Services in that process. Our own experience with the department is that they've been very, very interested in trying to improve their their processes. And in fact, I would assure the committee that in terms of our relationship to the department, when we need information to discharge our legal advisory function to the department, we've never had a difficulty getting that information from the agency. Now, that's a different question than the question, kinds of questions you all have raised, I think, about access to information for other purposes. But in terms of our statutory charge to advise the agency, we've not experienced any barriers to getting information.
Pete, does the agency have a history in dealing with any legal issues surrounding child welfare that they've perhaps had experience or competency in the past developed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we provide, we have a very large section of our department that provides advice to human services agencies, including the Department of Human Services. And in the kinds of cases that have been alluded to here in testimony, we often are involved in many aspects of those cases, including trying to facilitate the free flow of information within the restrictions that exist, and the Speaker alluded to many of those. Within those legal constraints, our office, for instance, has helped facilitate the flow of information from DHS to law enforcement agencies. And so we have experience in helping the Department of Human Services and, on the other hand, law enforcement from time to time get access to information they need, work together on the cases, and try and work their way through the really complicated legal framework in which these cases often arise.
And it seems to me that for the reasons you just described, that is why there is a feeling that this kind of effort would be most appropriately housed within the Department of Justice. I think a lot of the frustrations on the part of law enforcement and child welfare folks, advocates, legislators, is that there isn't that free flow of communication, necessarily because of some of the confidentiality, privacy issues that surround the personal information. Even when you're able to get releases from the parents, you still have the individual child's rights as well. And so I think the feeling is that justice can cut through a lot of that and make that information flow more smoothly so that they can work both with law enforcement and DHS, not as sort of even in an adversarial kind of way, but to bring folks together. And so I wonder then, in the context of the suggestion that was brought forward about some kind of an inspector general function within an individual agency, if that would have the effect that we're trying to accomplish.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think your question illustrates well my first point, which is I think the committee needs to be very clear about what it wishes to accomplish. What effect is it that you wish to accomplish? Sheriff Giusto's list of six particular issues, and I recognize that's not the exclusive list, but many of those are characterized by judgments about the allocation of administrative resources or decisions about how one is to train people or what resources one is going to create for after-hours contact and so forth. None of those are things that the Department of Justice, at least currently, has any unique specialized expertise to bring to bear on. If we were charged with assessing the adequacy of those systems, we would have to create or acquire the expertise necessary to make informed judgments about those features. If the committee identifies the free flow of information from transmission from, for example, from DHS to law enforcement, then that is an area in which the Department of Justice does have specialized expertise, because that's the barriers there are not willingness to share information in our view, but rather the legal issues that surround and pin in the information in different silos. And I would have to say, Mr. Chair, that although the discussion often is in terms of free flow of information from DHS to law enforcement, having been a prosecutor and done some of these cases myself, and also had some experience in working with these kinds of the more recent cases, it isn't always a question of the free flow of information from the agency to law enforcement. Sometimes law enforcement agencies have legitimate reasons to collect information in the course of their own investigations that they don't want to have fed back into the administrative or civil forums that often are going on in parallel. So the question of the freedom of information to move from one part of the system to another is an area where the Department of Justice has some expertise and can, and I hope people would characterize our past rule as having been historically helpful in accomplishing that.
Well, I mean, I suppose then I'll ask you to perhaps work us through an example of a situation where there have been reports of, there have been reports of child abuse. Law enforcement goes in to investigate. Child welfare authorities go in to investigate. And law enforcement is able to develop some information, well, quite a bit, that they feed to child welfare authorities. And then the child welfare authorities, through their investigation, develop information as well. But there, perhaps, is something that law enforcement has that the child welfare authorities don't have, and then vice versa, that would be perhaps important to sort of synthesize the whole issue. How do we get those two sides to get all the information, all the tools necessary to be able to protect those kids out in the open? Well, I mean, how do we get those issues out for everybody, for the decision makers?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's an important, as I've listened to the committee's discussion and the speaker's testimony and the sheriff's, I think that's a key question, and frankly, I don't know the answer to that question. I think that's it ought to be a part of your inquiry, including, I think, a real careful examination with DHS's assistance of systems that already have been created to try and address those needs. As I say, our office has been involved in a number of cases in which our instructions from the agency were to do everything that we can to facilitate the flow of information within the constraints that they have under law. And those are difficult case-by-case judgments to make. So I think that trying to reach an answer to the chair's question ought to be a very key part of what this committee, the effort this committee directs, but I can't answer that question as I sit here today.
Well, we're almost up on time, but let me ask you one other question, and maybe some other members of the committee have questions. My last question, I suppose, is did the Department of Justice engage in those CERT reviews that were conducted by the Department of Human Services in the wake of the recent tragedies? And if so, what role did the department have? And finally, does the department have a position on what's going on and why we're having these tragedies?
Mr. Chair, first, to your first two questions, yes, it's my understanding that we have assistant attorneys general who assist, at least, and I think have actually participated as members of at least some of those review processes. Our function there, again, is to provide the source of legal advice to the agency, and that's our current statutory charge, and our responsibility is to help the agency understand what law permits and where there are boundaries perhaps created by law, and also understand what its obligations are under law. So those are in generic terms, that's the nature of our participation in those reviews. I think that I'm individually not the right person to give you any kind of diagnosis about the system to the fact that we have had instances in which kids have been abused or killed. But I would say that I think part of it is that we're looking at a system that, in my observation, that the agency involved has been very interested in examining itself about what will transpire and in part in to look and see how it can improve its performance, that is DHS has. That's been my observation of the cases in which we've with which we, on which we have worked with DHS in those review processes. And I think in part it's a credit to the agency that, that questions have arisen about this because it's part of a self-examination process that they're engaged in. That's my personal observation of how the agency has behaved under these circumstances. You asked what my observation was, and so I think in part we're seeing these questions arise about individual cases in part because the agency is interested in trying to improve its processes. As to why we have these cases, we have, as you'll hear in a little bit, I think, in a separate item on your agenda this morning, we have a lot of kids who are being abused. And there are just a lot of those cases in the system. And I can't give you any diagnosis as to why there are occasional failures in the system, but we just have a lot. We have a high volume in these cases. There's no question about that.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick, and then Tomei, and then Bloom.
Thank you. I understand your role as providing AAGs to the agency, so you'd have an AAG working where your client would be Children Protective Services and OYA and other things, but don't you have independent authority to step in if you believe, say, children are being endangered in any of these agencies? And if you do have that independent authority to step in, what does it take to get a case to that level that would get you to do an AG investigation for one of these agencies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, we certainly do have, part of our mission is to ensure that the rule of law is adhered to. And so if we and when we see any agency, leave alone Department of Human Services, but any agency that is in our judgment exceeding its authority under law or failing to do something that the law requires, then we have a variety of tools that are available to us to bring that agency into compliance with law. They range from advising the agency directly, you are not complying with law, and our advice to you is you must conform your conduct to the requirements of law. There are a variety of consequences that an agency that didn't adhere to that advice would suffer, including the possibility that there are an array of things that can happen to that. We also do have a statutory authority under Chapter 180 to conduct what are defined as, oddly, as organized crime investigations, but the definition of that includes public officials who are violating laws that are inherently part of their duties. And so we have and will continue to do investigations of any state official or any other governmental official who is breaching the obligations of law in a criminal sense. So we have some criminal investigative authority for any public official who breaches a duty of law that's inherent in the nature of their office. So we do have an array of tools for those cases that we can exercise under law for those cases in which an agency simply is violating the law. So we do have those kinds of things. What we don't have is we don't have a statute that empowers us to force an agency to make a different judgment about the allocation of its resources within the boundaries of law that the agency is permitted to exercise. That is not a function that we perform, and as I say, that to the extent that that's a goal of this committee, that's currently not an area in which we have any unique expertise in DHS or indeed in other agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tomei.
My question is answered. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Representative Boone.
Well, I have to say that, and that was part of my question too, was don't you have some sort of authority to investigate employees, such as the OYA employee? And I guess my question is, if this unit had been in place, you know, taking the fact that Department of Human Services is extremely busy with caseloads and they're buried in paperwork, and while they're digging through the frontline trenches on their work, perhaps a unit such as this could tag these people. This guy had been reported by the family. He was a subject of jokes by his coworkers. I mean, that should have red flagged him earlier. And he'd been, I think, placed on administrative leave before. So my question is why was he still in the system? I know there's a criminal investigation going on. Why was the foster provider still in the system? Why was he still, after he had been assigned to another area, away from handling children, why was he still involved and doing this? And you take someone like the victim in this, the poor young man who eventually committed suicide because of all this, and I'm firmly convinced that's why he did it. He had no trust in the system that was placed in place to protect him. He had nothing. He had some family, you know, protection, but he was already in our system, and we're charged with protecting him, and we didn't. But people knew about it. It wasn't a surprise. So do you think, I guess, long question, if this unit was in place, would it be able to catch something like this before another tragedy occurred?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, first, as to the particular case, I'm not the right person to address the particulars of that particular case, so I beg off on observation about the particular case. But in the abstract, if your question is would the existence of some independent semi-autonomous or autonomous review process that was looking at these a perspective that's outside the day-to-day operation of the agency, does that have the potential to identify systemic problems that could contribute to such a case? I think probably the answer is yes. I mean, that makes sense to me, that in the abstract, that kind of function, whether it's brought about by an attitude on the part of the folks responsible for administering the program, or whether it's brought about institutionally by the assignment of that function by law to someone or some office, potentially, it could identify problems that could lead to cases like that.
President Cameron, did you have a question? Okay. All right. I think we're all set. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate your perspective, your ideas about how to refine our concept here. So thank you very much. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2010, and we will start with our informational hearing, the presentation by Fight Crime Invest in Kids Oregon, and ask the panel to come forward. I have about six names here, so I'll let you decide. Do you want to all come forward together or in two panels?
We are working.
No.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Everybody.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you here today on the current threat to safe foster homes for abused and neglected children. I'm Sheriff Bob Wolf. I'm with the Polk County Sheriff's Office, and I've been in law enforcement for 28 years, and I've been Sheriff of Polk County for the past six. I'm currently the President of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and I'm also a member of the anti-crime organization Fight Crime Invest in Kids Oregon. There are more than 100 police chiefs, the majority of sheriffs, district attorneys, and victims of violence in Oregon, and 2,000 law enforcement leaders nationally who have come together to take a hard-nosed look at what really works to give children the right start in life and protect our communities from future crime. You will be hearing today from several other members of the Fight Crime Invest in Kids Oregon, who are deeply concerned that a proposed new limit on national foster care funds will threaten the safety of vulnerable kids and increase crime in our state. The proposal to remove the current national commitment of safe foster homes for abused and neglected children and force states to leave kids in dangerous homes. Research shows that depriving abused and neglected children from getting foster care protection increases the risk of those children growing up to become violent criminals. Law enforcement leaders believe that the best place for children is with their families. But when it's clear that their safety is at risk, they need protection. Let me refer to an incident that occurred in Polk County just prior to Thanksgiving of last year, in which a neglected and abused child ended up dying, a six-month-old baby. When we got to the location and investigated this, we also found that there was a six-year-old child that was living in a total squalor because the family just did not know any better to take care of the children in the way that they were. And subsequently, just because of the neglect that was provided by the two parents who were living in a small travel trailer, this child suffocated on the floor of the trailer while the two parents sat right there in the home. I myself, and something that's not known by people outside of my immediate family, I'm also a person that was from a neglected family. And at the age of 9 in Southern California, if it wasn't for foster care, which I was temporarily placed in, I would have been left with my younger sister to just fend for ourselves because my mother had just run off and left us and had neglected us for some time. Foster care provides safe environments for the abused and neglected children. A federal Child and Family Services review of Oregon's child welfare system completed in 2001 reported that 6.8% of all victims of abuse and neglect in Oregon were re-abused or neglected within 6 months, typically by the people who originally abused them. This rate is 8 times higher than the rate of abuse and neglect in Oregon foster care, which is less than 1%. We know that safe foster homes and services are essential for more than the 9,000 Oregon children in foster care if they are to heal from their abuse and neglect and grow up to be productive citizens. Safe foster homes are also necessary to protect others in Oregon from future crime. Research shows that children who are abused or neglected and left in their homes but later need to be placed in foster care because of further abuse are more likely to commit violent crimes when they grow up than kids immediately placed in foster care. We know that the Oregon foster care system is now under intense scrutiny. We are all aware of the two recent tragic cases in Clackamas County where a 5-year-old was found bruised and emaciated in an overcrowded and inadequately monitored foster home. And a toddler died of head wounds after the state reunited him with his parents. We recognize careful deliberations are now underway to make improvements. We've heard some of that this morning. Today we are not here to lay any blame. Our goal is to ensure that Oregon can rely on national foster care funding to safeguard our most valuable children. We commend Chairman Dalto and the members of this committee for holding this timely hearing today because Congress may act on this dangerous proposal within the next few months, perhaps as part of a budget reconciliation bill. Our senators, Senator Gordon Smith and Senator Ron Wyden, are members of the Senate Finance Committee, which will review this proposal to change foster care funding. We know that Senator Smith and Wyden have a deep commitment to children. We count on their leadership to maintain this critical support for children. The law enforcement leaders and crime victims who make up Fight Crime, Invest in Kids Oregon ask you and the Oregon State Legislator to send a resolution to our state's congressional delegation to oppose this proposal. Innocent lives hang in the balance, abandoning the national foster care commitment to Oregon's abused and neglected children threatens our children's safety and our public safety. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sheriff Wolf, do you have the ability to put some sample language together on a resolution like that?
I can do that. Yes.
Right, we'll follow up on it. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Carla Peluso. I've been in law enforcement for 26 years and currently serve as the chief of police for the city of Gresham. I've served as chief for 2.5 years now. Early on in my career, I served as a patrol officer, as most of us do in this profession. I'd like to share with you a story of a Christmas Eve about 22 years ago, where as a patrol officer, I responded to a call of kids who had been left alone in their home for 8 to 12 hours in anticipation of their parents coming home. The parents didn't come home. We found them, actually, a couple hours later, highly intoxicated and unable to care for those kids. We took 3 children out of that home and sent them to foster care on Christmas Eve. More recently, as you're all aware, incidents of meth are certainly on the rise. And on the 29th of January this year, after the apartment managers had pounded and hollered on a door of an apartment, we responded. We had to use a battering ram to get into that home, found two adults in that home sleeping off the effects of meth, and a 4-month son who had been left unattended. That son was taken into foster care. On September 12th, of 2004, we responded to a call of a 10-month-old baby who had fallen 20 feet from an apartment window, having been left unattended, and he was able, this 10-month-old, was able to remove the cardboard that was supporting an air conditioner on a window, explored that window, and again ended up on the ground. Luckily, he was uninjured, but again, 2 adults we found sleeping off meth. That child was taken into foster care. Also in December of last year, 2004, we were working a high-risk search warrant to enter a house where we believed meth was being cooked as well as pipe bombs prepared. We had to completely change our strategy when we learned that there was a 4-month-old and a 6-year-old in the house. Did DHS support us in this? A foster family waited at the scene as we entered that home and removed 2 kids, those 2 kids, and sent them immediately to foster care. One of those children suffered the effects, the residual effects of being exposed to those meth chemicals. Again, in the course of my years, I've seen the best and the worst. The behaviors I've described certainly some of the worst. The best were the people who were willing to step forward as foster care providers. Child abuse and neglect is a serious problem in Oregon. According to official statistics, in 2003, more than 9,000 children in Oregon were confirmed victims of child abuse and neglect, and 14 children died from abuse or neglect. The number of abused and neglected kids continue to increase. In 2003, there were 15% more children who were victims of abuse and neglect than in 2001. As Oregon improves its ability to investigate and confirm cases of abuse and neglect, more safe foster homes will be necessary. Children First for Oregon, citing the latest data available from the state, released a report in January 2005 saying reports of child abuse or neglected abuse increased by 61% between 1994 and 2003. From just 2001 to 2003, reports of child abuse or neglect were up 17%, and confirmed cases of neglect or abuse were up 15%. Less than half, 48%, of the reports in 2003 of children being harmed or at a substantial risk of being harmed received further investigation after the initial intake. The percentage of reports investigated also varied widely by county. In 2003, 5,158 abused or neglected children were removed from their homes because it was decided they couldn't safely be there. As 2003 ended, there were more than 9,000 children living in foster homes in Oregon. abused and neglected children who are re-abused because of the shortage of foster care or are placed in inadequate or unsafe foster care will pay an enormous price day after day for the rest of their lives. However, they will not only be the victim of the proposed neglect, they will not be the only victims of the proposed neglect of the foster care systems. Others will also pay the price. Law enforcement and crime victims know that failing to protect and heal abused and neglected children sentence Oregon families to needless crimes and violence. For example, according to a new report, abandoning Oregon's most vulnerable kids, impact on crime, a proposed federal withdrawal of foster care funding pledge that Fight Crime, Invest in Kids Oregon is releasing today, research shows that when taken seriously, abused or neglected children are left in dangerous homes and have to be placed in foster care later due to more neglect or abuse. They are 20% more likely to grow up to be violent criminals than if they had been removed the first time. Among children who were abused and neglected and left in their homes, but later needed to be placed in foster care because of further abuse, 4 out of 10 committed violent crimes when they grew up. Leaving vulnerable children in abusive homes threatens first their safety and then the safety of our community when these children become adults. In addition to their heightened risk of becoming violent criminals, the emotional scarring of children who have been abused or neglected continues to damage their lives for years to come. For example, they are more likely to grow up unemployed and 2.5 times more likely to attempt suicide than other children. The key finding of Fight Crime, Invest Kids Oregon's new report is the proposed new limit on national foster care funding and would likely result in more children being abused and, when these abused children grow up, in more crime. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
My name is Martha Brooks. I'd like to thank the committee and the committee chair for inviting us here today. I'm the state director for Fight Crime Investing Kids Oregon. I thank you for allowing me to speak to you about this threat to our nation's vulnerable kids. Over 25 years, the nation has maintained a commitment to help states provide safe foster homes for each eligible, abused, or neglected child who needs one. When the number of children needing a foster home increased, the federal government promised it would match the state's help for each eligible child. Currently, whenever Oregon has to provide more eligible children with foster care homes, it can count on the federal government to provide a matching share of the needed support. Now, that commitment may be abandoned, substituted with federal payments to states that would have rigid limits. This new cap was proposed as an option to states in the president's budget and made mandatory for all states in legislation to be reintroduced shortly by U.S. House Ways and Means Subcommittee Chairman Representative Wally Herger of California. Unlike current law's commitment to match state payments for each eligible child who needs foster care, the proposed state cap would not budge even when child abuse caseloads surge. More than 3/4 of the states had an increase in demand for foster care in at least one of the 4 years from 1999 to 2003. And 6 states, including New Jersey and Texas, had at least a third more children in foster care at the end of the 4 years. Oregon's foster care caseloads have increased since 2001. There were 415 more Oregon children in need of foster care in 2003 than there were in 2001. If this proposed funding limit had gone into place in 2001, the number of Oregon children in need of foster care would have exceeded the limit in each of the following 2 years. When the number of children in need of foster care exceeds the cap funding, caseworkers will find themselves between a rock and a hard place. And I find it interesting that they probably aren't already between that rock and a hard place, struggling with the question, when no safe foster home is available, how high does the risk of further abuse or neglect have to be before I remove a child from a home? The likely result, more abused and neglected children will be left in homes where they have already been beaten, sexually abused, or severely neglected. Equally troubling, when funding is short, the children who are removed are more likely to wind up in overcrowded or unsafe foster homes instead of the nurturing homes they so badly need if they are to heal and go on to lead healthy, contributing lives. The cap payment to states in the legislation proposed by Representative Herger only matches the inflation rate the first year, and in real inflation-adjusted numbers is set to decline in subsequent years. Representative Herger has recently acknowledged that even the modest funding amounts in last year's bill may be cut even further due to budget constraints when the legislation is reintroduced this year. To make matters worse, historically capped funding to states is cut over time. Therefore, even if caseloads stay at current levels, states may soon have insufficient funds to help all of their abused and neglected children. The quality and safety of foster care placements would be jeopardized by lower funding, which would cause qualified foster parents to leave the system to be replaced, if they are replaced at all, by less qualified foster parents. The lack of high-quality foster parents or the simple lack of foster homes would mean that many children would face being left in dangerous homes. And we'll move on to the next.
Martha, while we're switching here, I understand you're having a press conference at 10:15? You're having a press conference at 10:15?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry we have the press, but...
That's okay. Where is it being held?
Downstairs.
In the Capitol press room? Okay. All right. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Raul Ramirez, Marin County Sheriff. I've been in public safety, combination of law enforcement and juvenile, for 32 years, juvenile probation officer before I came on with the Sheriff's Office, and with the Sheriff's Office for the last 30 years. 8 of those years, as this August, will be 8 years as Sheriff of Marion County. Over that time frame, neglected children, abused children, is an issue that not only affects me emotionally, but I would hope so with you with regards to this problem that is increasing to the form that it's getting out of control. Law enforcement has particularly been interested and concerned about this issue with the limit that is currently being considered to be placed on foster home capping in the state of Oregon with regards to the resources that will be coming to the respective states. Because we've watched not only over the years between cocaine, crack epidemic to our current phenomena of methamphetamine that is out of control. As recently as a couple of months ago, I took Senator Jackie Winters with me on a methamphetamine search warrant. And the purpose of this was to provide an insight and a firsthand experience to a legislator on the issues around methamphetamine and the seriousness of the problem in our community. In this particular case, you're talking about a small home, not well maintained, falling apart, and typical drug house, where you had two couples living in a two-bedroom small house with three children, drug paraphernalia all over, sexual paraphernalia all over. Subsequently, those three children were taken into custody, placed in state care, and all the adults were arrested and charged with respective drug crimes. This is one example of the epidemic that we're seeing with regards to the displacement of our children across the state, particularly here in Marion County. Methamphetamine has spread to many urban, suburban, and rural areas. As we well know in law enforcement, there is no community that is not affected by methamphetamine. The reason I'm highlighting methamphetamine is that it affects families, and in those families, of course, are children. We are on a record pace here in Marion County. The last quarter of this year, of 2004, 200 children were displaced, taken into custody, and placed in state care in Marion County. This first quarter, we're going to supersede that. We're on another record pace. For the year, we're going to supersede the last year's number of children taken into custody in Marion County. You heard some of the numbers on a statewide basis. Our district attorney attributes of his caseload at least 30% dealing with children that are neglected, abused, and ultimately placed in foster care. 30% are directly related to methamphetamine. And this is not decreasing. It is increasing. As law enforcement, as we aggressively try to address this issue, working in partnership with the Department of Human Services, without the assistance and help of the state and of the federal government, we're not going to be able to protect our future. These children are our future, regardless of the environment that they're growing up in. If we don't provide that nurturing support, get them into an environment that will help them develop, we're going to end up with some serious problems into the future. Again, these are our future leaders. According to the Oregonian, meth is the single biggest factor in the removal of children from abusive homes in Oregon. As I stated, in Marion County, we are on a record pace. Here in Salem, 1 to 2 children are born each week meth addicted, and that number has continued to increase. That's not a number that we are proud of. Ramona Foley, Assistant Director of Children and Families, Adult and Families, which is DHS, said, I think if we had some miracle cure and we no longer had to deal with meth, it would likely reduce, again, abuse and neglect caseloads by at least half. The demand for foster care homes is greatly needed. Law enforcement leaders are cracking down on meth use and busting more meth labs across the state. Yet we know long before that there are parents addicted to methamphetamine that their children will be abused and neglected. And a typical symptom with regards to methamphetamine is it's self-gratifying. You get to a point where you care as a parent, as an addict. You only care about yourself. You don't care about eating. So if you don't care about eating, you don't prepare meals for your children. Your children go to bed without eating, whether that be a day, 2 days. And we've seen the effects of the tragedy of those children. Again, but under the proposed new limit, there would be no commitment of national funding for additional abuse and neglected children. It threatens the child and children and public safety if we do not have the means to place these vulnerable children in safe foster homes in the state of Oregon. April 4th, in front of the Marion County Courthouse steps, we will be holding our fifth child abuse rally. And again, this rally is designed to raise the awareness in our community. And the reason we did it at the courthouse steps is, you know, it's only a block and a half from the Capitol, is just the sheer number of children that are abused. You heard Sheriff Wolf comment on the number of children abused in the state and neglected. The purpose of that rally, by hanging blue ribbons on one of our trees in front of the courthouse, is the number of children, over 1,000 children abused and neglected just here in Marion County. Again, that's one symbol of the seriousness of this issue. Please take into consideration the need of Oregon's need for foster homes. And thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm appearing on behalf of Attorney General Hardy Myers. Let me just share with you, I'll leave in light of the time, I'll be brief, and just share with you a little piece of my experience as a Deputy District Attorney in Marion County, which started in 1983. And it involved a scrawny street kid who was about 12 years old and apparently homeless and certainly without any adult protector, who was picked up by a 50-year-old parolee who was living in what was then known as the Senator Hotel, right out in front of the Marion County Courthouse at the bus stop. The parolee plied this 12-year-old victim with LSD, sexually abused him in his room at the Senator Hotel, and then recruited the kid to be an LSD distributor on behalf of the defendant. Defendant was apprehended, convicted, released from custody pending sentencing, and then absconded and never has been apprehended. It's one of the more haunting cases that I handled as a prosecutor. I think that if that kid had been in a safe foster home rather than being apparently a homeless kid, that I never would have had to prosecute that case. And to the extent that you can add your voice to a resolution that might encourage Congress to continue to send resources to Oregon to support more foster homes, the Attorney General and I think that would be a very good idea.
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families and appreciate the invitation from Fight Crime Investing Kids to be here today. What we know is that 36 local counties have a local community comprehensive plan that outlines from 0 to 18 the kinds of supports that children need in their community in order to reach their full potential and to succeed. So what matters most in helping all children and youth reach adulthood? What we know that all kids need adequate nutrition, they need health, and they need shelter. We know that they need safe, stable places in which to live, that they have care that is consistent. We know that they need basic care and services such as education, recreation, their health services, and mental health services. And we know that they need healthy relationships with their peers and with adults. And that includes at least one caring adult in their environment. And this comes directly from research out of the Search Institute that says this is the one thing that can be the most significant thing in a child's life. And we know that high expectations of a child and clear standards for them are going to help them succeed later on. Children who are placed in out-of-home, children who are placed in foster care, lack many of these core, very basic functions. So what are the effects if, in fact, policies are changed in these particular core supports? In order to reduce the number of children needing out-of-home care, states must be able to make substantial investments in both state and federal dollars to provide an array of services all along the continuum, again, from prevention to the most intensive services that are needed to aftercare when kids come out of particular environments. We know that Oregon child serving agencies and organizations, that includes both state and local government, and local private nonprofit organizations, are trying as much as they can to strengthen their collaborative efforts while engaging communities and leveraging additional resources in order to not only have prevention at the front end of the continuum, but again, to make sure that those essential supports are all along 0 to 18 years of age. Communities are already overwhelmed with the demand for services and the need to improve their community conditions. You have just heard many statistics around the meth issue. Meth has come to be the number one issue that communities are dealing with in terms of providing those needed services and supports. If, in fact, the federal government were to put a cap on the foster care system, that would absolutely be a horrendous essential element that each community needs in order to have those supports available for their kids. No community has the capacity to absorb children who are in those crisis situations without sacrificing most everything else that they are doing. So in conclusion, prevention means teaching parents how to provide for their children with the kind of care that will ensure that each of those children have the healthiest possible development. And it means for all of us that we must ensure we have adequate supportive foster care, because what a child learns today is what he or she will have to offer to society tomorrow. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I wish we had time for questions or comments from the panel. We don't, but let me just sort of take the opportunity on behalf of the panel to thank you all very much for your efforts on this issue. The information that we've heard today is alarming. The number of kids in foster care, the number of kids that are endangered, the number of kids that are found at meth operations or labs or in homes where parents are unable to care for them. And so we really appreciate all the work that you're doing to take care of those kids and to attack this problem, and we're going to try to give you all the help we can to do it. And a special note, since my sheriff is up there, Sheriff Ramirez, I've watched your work for my career in public service, and I admire what you do for child welfare in our community locally. We're hit very hard in Marion County with methamphetamine, and I appreciate everything that you do. So thanks for being here. Thanks to the panel.
Thanks
for bringing this forward. And
we'll get the resolution
when we're great. Representative Anderson, would you like to work with the panel to put some resolution language together so that we can move that forward?
Great.
Representative Anderson is going to help you out with that. Good luck on your press conference. Sorry we won't be able to join you, but we'll hear from you later. Great.
Thank you, Montrose.
We still have a little work to do. We're still in session. Where's Tomago? Colleagues, we'll stand at ease for just a moment.
Chair, you do that.
We'll call the meeting on the House Committee on Health and Human Services back to order. We have concluded our public hearing on House Bill 2010. We concluded our informational meeting where we heard the presentation from Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, Oregon. Now we're going to move on to the part of our agenda where we have three work sessions up on House Bill 2058, 2080, and 2103. So we'll just work through those. Colleagues, I'll refer you to your packets for the meeting this morning where you have copies of these measures that are hand engrossed, so we'll go through them. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2058. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2058, as you recall, we had a public hearing on February 9th and a work session on February 25th. House Bill 2058 creates separate accounts in the state treasury for the 9 health-related occupational licensing boards and repeals the sunset of the Board of Athletic Trainers. That was the Dash 1 amendment that we adopted at the February 25th meeting. What we have before us today, an issue that was raised in the public hearing, is the Dash 2 amendment, which removes the language that was an oversight at the time of the drafting of the bill, removing DHS from the accounting and the fiscal portion. We're removing that language in the Dash 2 and then transferring it over to the individual. I drew a blank. It's just removing DHS from the responsibility of the financial and accounting portions. Now, what I did get as we walked into the... This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I do have the fiscal impact on the Dash 1 and the Dash 2s. Briefly explaining and justifying that referral.
Thank you.
So, and again, Mr. Chair, the Dash 1s have been officially adopted, and what we have before us are the Dash 2s.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move that we adopt Dash 2 amendments of 315 and append them to House Bill 2058 as it's previously been amended by the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2058. Are there any questions? Is there any discussion? Any objections? The Dash 2 amendments are ordered adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Inasmuch as many of the health licensing boards in the state are affected, and this measure does have a subsequent referral, I move that we pass House Bill 2058 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a do-fast recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2058 as amended with a do-pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Are there any questions? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. House Bill 2058, as amended, having received a constitutional majority, is reported to the House Committee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2058. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2080. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you may recall former Representative Bill Markham presented this bill to us on March 14th. At that time, they spoke to an amendment. We have that amendment in front of us. That's the dash one. This is asking the Department of Human Services to establish a program informing retired physicians and healthcare providers about the laws to increase volunteer participation. What the amendment does is removes the language directing DHS to recruit the physicians, and it we've included uninsured low income patients on line 18, and we've limited the liability. The legal liability to health clinics only for the situations involving the assistance services or advice provided by that health care provider working in a voluntary capacity. At that time, it was requested that we consider or check into rescinding the referral to Judiciary Committee. We have gotten approval from the Speaker's office, so that may be reflected in the motion if the committee so chooses.
Thank you, Sandy. So, colleagues, we needed to tighten up language on this bill. It's been tightened up. The concerns that were addressed privately by some of the different associations were resolved. So we have a good bill here. Representative Greenlee, you have
Yes, sir. I do have a question.
Sure.
We've amended the health clinic definition by adding a specific sentence, and I wonder, is there a standard definition of health clinic? Because this, you're talking about uninsured low-income people without charge. In fact, some of these clinics rely on being able to get some revenue from insured low-income patients. And I wonder whether this is an idiosyncratic definition of what health clinic means in this context.
Yeah, Representative Greenlee, we had this issue come up in another bill,
right.
And you helped me identify some pretty specific language. Do you recall what that language was?
No, it was on the dental hygienist bill. And
right.
Maybe somewhere along the line, we need to create a formal definition of what we mean by this. And I mean, I don't see it as a problem going through this time, but
sure.
If we have 9 definitions of this and 9 different bills, it might help to get it together in a standard definition. So
that's a good point. When we say health clinic, we want to define exactly what constitutes a health clinic and what we're looking at for this point. Well, Representative Greenlee, would you be opposed to moving this one
no.
out today?
No.
And then on the Senate side, as this goes over, I would be happy, or maybe you would be willing to walk over and work with the Senate to just refine that.
Great.
That's okay.
Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Good.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
Just by way of question and explanation, the insertion of uninsured does not preclude them from having insured patients in this regard, but what it does do, I think, is it identifies that there are clinics, health clinics, who work on a greater number of uninsured than perhaps they do on insured individuals and patients. So I appreciate the fact that there may be some specific definition at some particular time, I think that the point is well taken that we ought to see if there isn't a definition. We've got definitions for almost everything. There's a different definition for federal health clinics too.
Well, qualified.
We've got the frontier health clinics, and there's different definitions for all of them.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
With that, Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 1 amendments of March 21st be appended to House Bill 2080.
Thank you very much, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2080. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The Dash 1 amendments are ordered adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Recognizing that the subsequent referral to House Judiciary has been rescinded or has been authorized for rescission by the Speaker, I move that House Bill 2080 be moved to the floor of the House. Will do pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2080 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the House Committee on Judiciary be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Anderson?
Aye.
Representative
Boone?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Greenwald?
Aye.
Representative
May?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Chair Dolker?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2080, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Chair assigns Representative Morgan as the carrier to this bill. We will close the work session on House Bill 2080. We will open a work session on House Bill 2103. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 2103 is a bill that relates to the Health Licensing Office. It's requesting to change the Health Licensing Office to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. So there's a name change. It also has conforming changes to statutes relating to the regulation of that agency. It authorizes the Health Licensing Office to issue single facility license to certain facilities that provide multiple services within that facility. We have a Dash 1 amendment. What the Dash 1 amendment dated 317 is doing, it has included original license language on page 7. You have a Hannah Gross bill there on page, and then it deletes the current language relating to photocopying costs and inserts more, I don't want to say broad, but more inclusive language. Costs of compiling, photocopying, preparing, and delivering copies of documents and records have been inserted, replacing that old original language. It's also deleting all the fees on page 28, and you will see that, that then the fees will be established by rules. This has a ways and means referral. We also have a fiscal impact on that I will pass out so that committee may. Okay, you can take
it. Mr. Chair?
Sorry, President Butler.
By way of question to staff, the reason for the subsequent referral, I assume, is because of the fee-driven issue, which will need to be decided in each of the health licensing boards. Is that my understanding?
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I was distracted.
The subsequent referral is because of the licensing fee structure and the potential changes within the health licensing agencies.
That is correct.
Thank you.
However, I may just make a side comment that with the Ways and Means and not having received the fiscal, the Speaker has not been approached about the possibility of reviewing the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And you will note that the fiscal impact statement says, under the comment section, the fiscal impact of this bill is indeterminate. So,
but Mr. Chair, again, by way of question of staff, if the health licensing agencies that are covered under the new HLO need to address the fiscal impact of how they are going to accommodate, particularly with regard to those that are involved in the single license or single facility licenses, where they have multiple professions that are practiced in the same office, I think that probably is the venue where usually general government or the Health and Human Services addresses these to make sure, and that probably just needs to come up at the same time they're running those license authorities out in the Ways and Means process. So I don't know, is it the chair's desire to seek authorization to not have this? I don't know how you can do that, where they're going to have to consider it relative to the fee base in those multiple practice areas.
Representative Butler, we're sending this to Ways and Means.
Right. I was just wondering if it was your request for not sending it to Ways and Means.
No.
Okay. With that, Mr. Chair, I would move dash one amendments of March 21st be appended to House Bill 2103.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2103. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The amendments are ordered adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2103 as amended with the dash one amendments be passed to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the House Bill 2103 as amended to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? House Bill 2103 is ordered to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. We'll close the public the work session on House Bill 2103.
You don't need a roll call.
There was an objection, and we don't have to. Would you prefer we do a roll call?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2103. Anything else, colleagues, for the good of the order? How about that? 3 minutes.
Yay!
For the first time.
Yeah.
Colleagues, before we adjourn, some housekeeping. We have two meetings, just as a reminder, planned on for this committee outside of the building. We're going to be going to Eugene to an alcohol and drug treatment facility on the 30th of March, at the end of this month. Excuse me, maybe the 31st. I'll get that date. It's a Wednesday. Is it Thursday?
32nd.
Sorry. Okay, let's clarify that. Sandy, what is the date?
It's the 31st. It's a week from Thursday.
What time?
Right? 30 days.
30 days has September. All the rest I can't remember.
30. All the rest is 31, except for February when we have...
It's the 31st. Right. It's Thursday the 31st, an alcohol and drug facility in Eugene. After that, we will have a public hearing where we will be hearing a House measure that has to do with alcohol and drug.
2500.
Thank you.
What time?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're looking at leaving at 2 o'clock to get down to Eugene at between 3 and 3:30, do our tour, and then have our public hearing to leave Eugene no later than 6:30 back here to Salem.
Which clinic is that?
I haven't gotten the details yet. Damian is working on that.
I think I know which one.
College, by the end of the day, we'll send you each an email with all the specific details, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
And the other one?
The 31st. The other one, we had intended to go to Ontario to do a program on rural health. We will not be going to Ontario. Instead, we'll be going to Baker City to accommodate Representative Greenlink and myself in terms of time, because we have another obligation on the same weekend. But that's going to be April 9th, which is a Saturday, where we will be doing a presentation on rural health. It would be great, colleagues, if we could have a strong showing for that meeting. It's in Representative Butler's district, so I imagine Representative Butler will most definitely be there. If you can't make it, although I strongly encourage you to make it, if you cannot make it to Baker City, which is a fine town with lots of fine restaurants and beautiful scenery that you'll enjoy very much, we can probably try to accommodate you at least for the public meeting portion by having you conference call in so that everybody is,
what time is that?
Present. We're going to tentatively schedule the meeting for 1. Was it 1:30 or 1? 1 o'clock.
Saturday.
It is Saturday. Saturday.
1 o'clock, yeah. And we're going to go for 90 minutes for a tour and then 90 minutes for the public hearing after the tour. So we should be done at 4:30, which will give you enough time to get back to the Portland area by a reasonable time if you didn't want to stay in scenic Baker City.
Nice interpretive center there.
Yeah.
It's
really busy.
That's a good stuff to do. I haven't been to the interpretive center there yet. So.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just due to the time, I believe that staff and I will probably be spending Saturday night. So if that's something that you folks want, we can maybe look at doing something in block, and folks that we leave early Sunday morning so you still have part of a weekend.
I have a Friday meeting.
Thank you.
So, and staff will make accommodations for your stay and your meals, so we'll have that all wrapped up. We'll get you an email by the end of the day.
I will try. I apologize if you have anything in the
afternoon. Do you know whether there's an elections committee on that Thursday afternoon?
I don't have an answer.
Did you adjourn?
No. With that, we'll adjourn the hearing.
We'll check with that.